We're talking with Robert McLuhan, author of Randy's Prize, What Skeptics Say About the Paranormal, Why They're Wrong, and Why It Matters. He also writes online a blog and for the Psi Encyclopedia. We have links to both of those. He's written hundreds and edited hundreds of articles that that you can read right now. Well, hopefully not right now, maybe in an hour from now, online, and see what kind of work Robert does. In a moment, we're going to continue our conversation talking about the parameters of science, what the role of science should be in investigating frontier sciences, such as the ones we discuss on this program all the time. Then in a bit, we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments for my guest here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert McLuhan, in your book, you make a pretty good case that there's some excellent research being done all over the world on the topics we're discussing: near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing. You mentioned about Dean Radin, who was my guest on this program a couple of weeks ago. Really good science being done, and yet it gets ignored by a larger scientific community.
Well, I you know, it's a very good question, what to do about it. There is this sort of barrier, sort of a virtual barrier between the two fields. So, you know, if people like me, I suppose we think about how we can, you know, do something to communicate the work that's been done by scientists like Dean Radin and Rupert Sheldrake and others. My own view of this is that there's a real lack of information. I've noticed that, for instance, when a skeptic writes an article, that article will quote other skeptics. It will very rarely quote the literature itself, the scientific literature, and that's not good. But when I started to think about this, I realized that actually one of the reasons why is because in a lot of cases, the literature isn't very available. So, you know, where would you go to find it? I happen to be lucky because I live in London. I live quite close to the Society for Psychical Research. So I could go there to spend time in its library. And I could read through all its journals and proceedings, going right back to, you know, 1882, I think it started. So I had a wealth of information that I could read, and I was able to educate myself. But most people don't have that possibility because you won't find that information in any library. You won't find it in any bookshop. So I set myself the task of trying to make the information a bit more available. And I first tried by sort of creating a website to put some of the information, to upload some of the information. But I had to abandon it because it was such a big job. But then a few years ago, I was lucky enough to get some funding from the Society for Psychical Research, quite substantial funding actually, which I was able to use to create what we call the Psi Encyclopedia. And for your listeners, Psi, P-S-I, is the word that parapsychologists now use to describe the force, if you like, the energy, the phenomena, related to telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, and precognition, where it appears in any context. So the Psi Encyclopedia, which you can easily find online, now has some 300 articles written by experts in all these different fields on a variety of subjects. So now for the first time, you can go online and you can find authoritative descriptions of the various topics and aspects of these topics. And you can also find links and references to the main literature. And eventually, I hope to start uploading some of the actual reports themselves, going back to the 19th century. So you'll have a lot of the original work to read as well.
Well, you have some great cases in there and great topics, and reference some really solid scientists who've done research in these areas. Remote viewing is one of them. Targ and Putoff at Stanford Research, who basically started the American program, The Army and CIA continued that research for 20 years. There are some who suspect it is still going on at some level. The Russian government was doing it for a long time, probably still is. So much of what was produced, the information produced by that program, has remained classified. But what we do know about it is fairly impressive. And they've just kind of been dismissed with a wave of a hand, as if it's not real.
I know, it's remarkable. But, you know, that's the times we live in.
You mentioned Uri Geller in the book, and of course Geller was at SRI and was a test subject. And because he's an entertainer, and you write about this in your book, because he's an entertainer, there's an assumption that he's like James Randi. It's sleight of hand. Everything that he does is a trick, as opposed to psychic abilities that he was able to fool, put off, and targ, even though. They don't acknowledge, the critics don't acknowledge the test conditions that you write about in your book.
Yes. Well, no, I agree. And this again was one of Randi's hatchet jobs. And, you know, I think it sort of needs to be penetrated to be understood. I mean, basically the circumstance here was that Targan put off what's Geller in an isolation box in a sort of acoustically isolated booth. And I know a little bit about these sorts of things because I used to run a recording studio a long time ago, and I actually built one of these things. And it's acoustically shielded, obviously. The point is so that sound can't get in. But it's also blocked off. So, you know, you don't actually have any visuals to the outside world at all. And they put Geller inside it. And they asked Geller to reproduce drawings which they made outside. So they'd draw something like a chair or a wheel or something. And they'd ask Geller to try and understand by telepathy what that drawing was and reproduce it. And Geller actually succeeded. And this material was declassified quite recently, 2 or 3 years ago. And actually created a bit of a stir. There was quite a lot in the media about it, but it did actually show that Geller got it. He nailed it. I mean, he got these drawings made very accurate representations of them by telepathy. Now, the narrative that in the skeptics, their explanation of it is based on James Randi. And James Randi said that he'd actually visited the facility. I believe he visited it. And he discovered that there was a hole in the side of the booth. And his explanation was that Geller had simply looked through the hole and he'd seen the drawings pinned up on the wall opposite the booth. And that's how he was able to replicate it. Now, in fact, I can't think of any reason why there would be a hole in the size of an isolation booth, because that would defeat the whole purpose, certainly not at eye level. And when somebody related to the parapsychology field went to check on this, he found that there was no hole there. There was actually a hole at floor level, which actually makes perfect sense, because you need a hole for the cables to go through. So, you know, why is that discrepancy there? What is the meaning of it? It just looks as if, and I'm afraid this is very often the case, as if Randi just bends the truth or makes stuff up. And there are lots of contexts in which we know this is true. And in fact, I think he's on record as actually having admitted it. This is about perception. It's about creating an alternative perception that allows people to form their own narrative. But there are cases like this that you can find, which do make these things very clear, as long as you're willing to get to the bottom of it.
It's as if all you need to do is come up with any kind of an explanation, no matter how implausible it might be, and that works. I mean, it's like, you know, $100 bills can be counterfeited, but not all $100 bills are counterfeits.
No, exactly, you know? Yes. There's another one, if I may. I mean,
sure.
This one intrigues me, and I actually, it was one of the things that really attracted me to this whole subject, is the explanation about the out-of-body experience. excuse me, or the near-death experience as well. That element of it when you're out of your body and you're looking down at it, and you're also picking up, you're observing the scene around you, and you're hearing conversations and observing things going on around your inert body. And I mean, this absolutely fascinates me. And I was very curious to know what explanations skeptics would have about this, because it is very difficult to explain. And the current one seemed to be one of the favorites, is that when people are anesthetized, we're talking about hospital situations here, obviously, since these things happen to people who suffer cardiac arrest in operating theaters. In a hospital situation, the patient is under general anesthetic. And the explanation here is that general anesthetic doesn't always work, or at least it's not 100%. So an individual may be lying there being operated on, but actually have some sort of residual hearing. The phrase is very often used, residual hearing. So that person may be hearing conversations by the surgeons and the nurses and the theater staff and so on. And later they may be reconstructing in their imaginations what happened around them. And in some strange way, they create this sense of having heard and seen things around them when they were unconscious that they could not possibly have heard by normal means. So in other words, this is another way that a narrative is created, a sort of a counter-narrative. And it may not really hold up. I mean, you could argue with it on all sorts of grounds. And you could also point to all sorts of cases where it could not possibly be true. But as long as you have that narrative there, then it does its work.
Yeah, of course. There are so many cases, we've talked about them on this program, where people access information they could not have gotten any otherwise. They were actually outside their bodies looking around, sometimes traveling out of the room. It's not something they overheard.
Yeah.
And likewise for out-of-body experiences. Now, you had mentioned, I don't know if you want to get into personal data, but you had some experiences, or at least were exploring some possibilities because of meditation. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Well, actually, I haven't. I mean, curiously, for somebody who writes about these things, I've had very few personal experiences of my own, and people sort of encourage me to open up about them. And to be honest, there isn't really much to talk about. And I suppose, in a way, that's why I'm very interested in hearing about other people's. But yes, I can explain how meditation got me into this, because I started to meditate as an antidote to stress. I'd actually started up a small business, and it wasn't going terribly well. In fact, it wasn't going at all. I just didn't have any customers. And I saw a poster saying, you know, stressed out, try TM, that's Transcendental Meditation. So I thought, well, that couldn't hurt, you can try anything. So I went along and did a little course, and I started to meditate. I was very glad I did. I kept it up intermittently over the rest of my life. I still do. But in the course of that, I started to encounter the basic ideas of meditation, where it comes from, and reading around Buddhism and Hinduism and so on. And that's when I discovered the whole idea of psychic abilities, psychic phenomena. But one of the things that interested me was the idea of creative visualizing. Is where you visualize, you know, if you want to change your life in some way, then you visualize a better life, or you visualize what you want to come into your life, and you do it in a meditative state in order to act on your unconscious mind, if you like, to make that happen. So I started to do that, and basically I visualized my business booming. I had nothing to lose by it. I'm not sure I had any great faith in it, but I thought, you know, it's got to try something. And long story short, it actually worked. Very, very quickly. All sorts of things started to happen. I started to get meetings with interesting people. Interesting people came to work for me. They had connections of their own, which started to work. And within 2 or 3 weeks, I was booked out. And I never looked back. So, that had quite an impact on me. I thought, that's interesting. And I can't say that, it made me, it sort of made me a convert overnight or anything, but it sort of got my interest, and it made me start to think about how there could possibly be a relationship between the stuff that goes on in our heads and the stuff that actually happens in our lives. And that's something that I've pursued that with interest. And I, obviously that leads to things like telepathy and so on. So that's where I started to investigate.
There's a story you tell in the book about an incident involving tulip bulbs. I don't know, coincidence or suggestion or what? Why don't you tell that?
Coincidence is a very interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm interested. I think that one of the things that, if people are interested in psychic phenomena or have had an experience, it's very likely to have been a precognitive dream, that is a dream of something that happens in the future. This is something that, seems to happen a lot to people. But of course, you can dismiss it as complete coincidence. And of course, that is the skeptic explanation. So, if you wake up having dreamed of a terrible air crash and an air crash happens that very day or has happened the night you were dreaming, you're inclined to make that connection and think that there is some sort of significance in it, when actually it was just pure coincidence. So I'm interested in the idea of coincidence, and I have noticed coincidences occurring in my own life, and I'm curious about what significance, if any, to attach to them. And this particular incident concerned some tulip bulbs, which I plant every year on my outside my house. I have flower pots. In fact, I have three tubs on three windowsills. And I went to the market where I buy flowers, and I bought three bags of tulips in different colors, and they put them into separate bags. And I'd intended to plant them out in separate boxes. So I'd have one box with white tulips, one with red, and one with yellow. But the bags got wet and they broke, so they all got mixed up in a single bag. So I thought, I'll just have a nice medley of different colors in the boxes. That'll work well too. But when I planted them, when they came up, a few months later, but in some miraculous way, they had actually sorted themselves to my original scheme. So I got red in one box, white in another, and yellow in another. and I thought, how is that possible? I mean, I'm not saying there's anything paranormal about it, because actually, yes, that could be pure coincidence. So actually, I use that as an example, not necessarily as something spooky, but, something that could go either way, really.
Well, you could do the math on that somehow, right, with the number of tulips?
Absolutely, yes, you could work out statistically. And actually, statistics is a very big part of parapsychology. In fact, it's pretty essential to it, because these days you don't say, well, subjectively, that's a very close match, very interesting, it must be significant. What you do is you do a whole lot of experiments, and then you judge them individually, and then you come to some sort of statistical understanding of overall how likely is that to have happened by chance. And parapsychology has some extraordinary results.
Dean Radin shared some of those with us a couple of weeks ago when he was here. Right. He does these massive studies, thousands of different incidents and experiments, and he looks for statistically significant differences. And we're going to take another break. We'll be back with more of my guest, Robert McLuhan, talking about Randy's Prize and how science views skepticism and vice versa. We'll be right back. Robert, before we go to the phones, I wanted to ask you about the section of your book that deals with psychologists. It's critiquing the critics. If you apply the same kind of standards that psychologists use to explain away paranormal or supernatural topics, how do they do?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I think they fall down. I mean, that's what I'm suggesting. They're very prone to write books about critical thinking. That's been a very large genre of books in the last two decades. and they sort of lecture us about how easy it is to make mistakes and all the different things that can, you know, confirmation bias and so on, that can cause people to go astray. But then in this particular topic, they don't apply it to themselves at all. You know, they just fall into all the same traps. So a very interesting question.
You know, there's a guy named Ray Hyman who gets mentioned in these discussions now and then, who is pretty diehard in his skepticism in debunking psi topics. And he keeps getting asked to evaluate programs. At least there are two examples that you mentioned in your book. One is a remote viewing program where he is asked for his opinion as if it's not already predetermined. And I don't remember what the other program was, but it was a larger psychic research program that he's asked to evaluate.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, it's very interesting. I mean, there is quite a long story attached to this, but the basic is that he was asked to, I think he's one of three judges, and he got basically another skeptic, a colleague, James Alcock, also a psychologist, as a sort of assistant. But there was another one who decided against them that you know, the phenomena being described was potentially genuine, and that it amounted to good evidence. And this frustrated Hyman greatly. And basically, they arranged matters so that his counter view wasn't represented at all. So it was a bit of a scandal about that. And I think institutionally, it is the case that skeptics seem to have the power to override counter opinion. So, you know, there is that bias there.
You mentioned in the book something called the Bogle threshold. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a term which is very current in British psychical research circles. And I think it was a member of the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, who came up with that idea of the Bogle threshold. It's just a handy phrase, which refers to the point at which you can't actually accept what you're being told or what you're hearing. And I think actually we all have that. But it may affect us in different ways. I'm just trying to think of an example of things that, there are things that reach my Bogle threshold. For instance, the idea of materializing mediums, an ectoplasm. I mean, the idea that a medium could generate a fully functioning human being or the appearance of it in a seance affects me. I just, you know, it's just too much for me to take on board. So in a way, that's my Bogle threshold. That's where the mind boggles at it and can't accept it.
Obviously, there are mediums who are frauds, and there are mediums who, as you mentioned before, can figure you out based on subtle clues. You think there are some mediums that have some kind of genuine inexplicable ability, right? I mean, that some of them are able to do things that they shouldn't be able to do.
Yes. No, I think mediumship's a genuine phenomenon. And I'd always encourage people to check out the history of hypnotism, because that's where it all starts, you know, in the early 19th century. Because that's when people discovered that the hypnosis in a certain way seems to facilitate some kind of telepathic connection. And I think mediums can see some way to be able to tap into that. It's a genuine phenomenon.
What is the mechanism by which, say, they would connect with the dead? I mean, other than hypnotizing the person who's in the room, you know, is there some sort of branch of physics that explains it?
No, it's not. It's something to do with consciousness. It's something to do with how the mind works. And that's why I raised, it's not that there's a direct relation between hypnotism and mediums, because they're not hypnotists. That's not what they're doing. But there is something about the human mind that once you break through some kind of barrier, then all sorts of interesting things happen. And that seems to happen with hypnosis, at least temporarily. And it does interest me greatly, and I don't think this has been very much remarked within parapsychology itself, that so many of these interesting episodes in all sorts of different contexts seem to start with some kind of hypnosis episode, where the person at the center of the episode has been hypnotized for some reason. It might be, you know, for some therapeutic reason. And this seems to have triggered something that leaves them in a state where paranormal seeming phenomena seem to happen quite easily. It happens with the near-death experience as well. Survivors of that say that for weeks, months, even years afterwards, you know, they can seem to be able to read people's thoughts, for instance, to know what's about to happen and so on. It has something to do with consciousness. And I think that that's the key thing, that for the future, that's where science needs to focus its energies. If we want to understand these matters, that will be the key.
We're going to take some calls. First-time caller, Cynthia in Massachusetts. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've never called a radio station before, so this is my first time.
Welcome.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I have a story for the guest I thought he might be interested in. My mother was a nurse on a surgical ward in a hospital. This is probably back in the 70s. And she had a patient who coded one day that, you know, she had a heart attack and for all intents and purposes was dead. And they had to bring the machine in to restart her heart. And when she woke up, she said to my mother, "What is the red monster?" Now, my mother told me this story. She said that this woman was dead when they brought in the machine to revive her. And, you know, she wouldn't have been able to hear that. And she asked my mother what the red monster was. And my mother said, "That's the machine. That's the nickname we have for the machine that starts your heart again." And the woman also told my mother that when she was, for all intents and purposes, dead, that she was floating above her body and she could see what the nurses and doctors were doing to her. And then when they revived her, she came back into her body. So yes. I just thought you might find that an interesting story.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And you know, these are very common stories, but it's only relatively recently that we started to hear about them since the 1980s. Before that, they were almost completely unknown. But it's the job of one of the jobs of scientists to get together with people who've had these experiences and to hear about them and get the details and analyze them. So thank
you. It sounds like this case, she was not under medication. She was dead. It sounds like it anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you, Cynthia. Appreciate it. We're going to Joe in Monterey, California. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, George. Thank you for taking my call. I've been in this field for a very, very long time. I have a large spectrum of experiences. I'm a professional healer, and I use different altered states to help heal my clients. I do past life travel, the whole gambit. But at one time, many years ago, I was at college, and I find that I took a course in parapsychology, and it was like a roadblock. It was a screaming skeptic. And I find that there are two battle cries of the skeptic, and they use these two different expressions. One is called Occam's razor and horizon line. And these two expressions is like it puts you in a position of not only that you have to prove it, but under certain conditions, and there are very limited conditions. And if you're dealing with psi phenomena, you can't have those limited conditions because you are unbounded at that point. You're working with a higher state. These are practitioners. Also, that when a practitioner is working with a skeptic, they put up a block and you can't read them. It's very difficult unless you're an incredible reader. And I don't like to read people. I like to work with people where they get their own answers, so they get empowered. So I don't deal with the psychic and their problems, but at times I do channel my higher self and even my higher or my superconscious mind, and I think you know those states. But these two different expressions.
Yeah, Joe, we're going to let Robert weigh in here on what you've been saying. Thank you for the comments. Robert, any thoughts?
Yes, thank you. I'm very familiar with these. I mean, it's like Randy's pies. It's the Occam's razor is a sort of a device. You know, you just sort of say Occam's razor and, you know, the problem goes away. Occam's razor, incidentally, is Occam was a medieval philosopher who argued that in essence, the simplest solution is probably the best one or the most economical solution, the one that requires the least amount of coming up with new ideas and entities to explain it, and that's a, you know, something, it's a sort of scientific watchword, really. So one sort of understands why skeptics use it, because it's much simpler to explain mediums as frauds than to start creating a whole panoply of spirit world and so on. But it doesn't really explain anything, and it is really just a device.
You had, of course, your book is focused on James Randi, or at least in the title of it. There was an incident where he had was invited to participate with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show when Uri Geller was the guest, and they had a setup where Geller was asked to perform some sort of a feat and was unable to do so, and they basically used that as proof. Aha, you're a fraud because we block you from using any of your normal tricks. My reaction was sort of like, the best basketball player in the world can't hit three pointers every time he does it. I mean, because you're not able to do it every time doesn't mean it's not real. But of course, who knows? I don't know what your take is on that incident.
Well, I mean, I think that skeptics do have an inhibiting effect, unfortunately. And that is the thing about psi is, the whole psychic thing is that it is very deeply psychological. It has to do with the mind, and it's a sort of a shared mind. And I think parapsychologists are starting to recognize that all sorts of influences can occur, and a particular experimenter can have routinely successful results and somebody else have routinely unsuccessful ones. It's a mix of psychologies. And of course, if you're sitting next to a very extreme skeptic, then it's very likely that he will inhibit anything happening.
We're going to Walt in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Walt.
Hello, Mr. Knapp. As you know, I'm one of your resident skeptics, agnostics, atheists, whatever you want to say. With all due respect to Mr. McLuhan, I believe it is, I think that belief, whether it's religious belief or belief in the paranormal or ufology, if it's belief without healthy skepticism, I think you get into brainwashing. Now, psychologists tell us that the brain is its own pharmacy, it's its own drug pusher, if you will, and certain stimuli cause the brain to release these endorphinic or dopaminic substances, which are not unlike hallucinogens in their effect, similar to LSD. So you might say that the brain is constantly playing tricks with us. It can be argued whether, there is really such a thing as reality itself. You could say that, well, reality is a trip. You know what I mean? And obviously, we have the problem with the radical Islamists today, the 9/11 incident where they believe that they're have to rid the world of the great Satan, and they martyr themselves. They're so brainwashed. And we had this phenomenon in World War II with the kamikazes.
We got you. I think you might find that Robert agrees with much of what you said there. Walt, Robert, you want to weigh in?
No, absolutely. I don't think, of course, you can't have belief without skepticism. That's the whole point of science. I think we're not arguing here that, that skeptics are mistaken in being skeptical. I think we're arguing that the skeptics that we're talking about are mistaken in not really taking on board all the arguments and just arguing in a very one-sided way. But certainly one needs to be skeptical about these things.
Yeah, well, the whole sort of point of the book is that skeptics need to apply the same rules of skepticism to themselves, because they get to the point where they're zealots and not really fairly evaluating what evidence exists. Try to get one more call in. Nicole from Arizona on the first-time caller line. Nicole, better make this a quick one. How you doing?
Yes, I'm great. Great to talk to y'all. I just wanted to say I'm one of those that have died on the table during surgery, and they had to bring me back. And after they brought me back, I was able to tell my mother exactly where I was, what I saw, relatives, and I kept begging to come back. And I could see Jesus, but I could only see the back of him, and he was surrounded with children. And as I begged, I could see myself coming back from that tunnel. And I woke up, and they put me in the wrong room, and I told them, I'm in the wrong room. I need to be in the room that has the picture of Jesus in there. And they kept telling me, no, I was in the wrong room. But I was moved later on, come to find out I was in the wrong room. And when they put me in the room, there was the picture of Jesus.
Nicole, thank you for sharing your story with us. I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you very much. I hope you'll call back again. Robert McLuhan, thanks very much. I really enjoyed your book. I hope people will check it out, and I hope they will also check the links that we have to your other work online.
Thanks, George.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks also to my earlier guest, James Donovan. Shoot for the Moon is also a great read. And I want to thank my colleagues there at Coast, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galanti, and producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'm back next Sunday night. Good night.